Welcome to 30 Brave Minutes, a podcast of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of North Carolina at Pembroke. In 30 Brave Minutes, we'll give you something interesting to think about. Joining the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, Jeff Frederick, are Ray Sutherland from the Department of Philosophy and Religion, Charles Beam from History, Richard Gay from Art, and Joss Bussman from the Department of Music. Their topic for the day, the Reformation.
500 years ago, in October of 1517, theologian Martin Luther sent a list of discussion topics, 95 of them to be exact, to an archbishop of the Catholic Church. He may have also tacked them on the door of the All Saints Church in Wittenberg. It makes the story a little richer to think he did, but it's not perfectly clear whether he nailed them or not. Soon enough, these ideas were printed and disseminated far and wide across Germany and eventually much of Europe. Those that could read, read them. Those that could not, gathered at local watering holes and in other public spaces to hear what Luther thought should be talked about. Prominent among the topics was the sale of indulgences, a notion that allowed people to provide money to the church in exchange for a reduction in the time one might spend in working off the punishment for committing an excessive quantity or grievous quality of sins. Not every one of the 95 theses discussed indulgences, and as discussion topics, they only appear as a series of sentence-long ideas. But from these theses, say 17 through most of the end of the document, Luther is focused like a 16th century laser beam on the idea that salvation, or remission of sins, or reduction of penance time could be accomplished in ways that either did not reflect his grasp of Scripture or provided an unequal access to benefit for those with disposable money. This troubled Luther, who took his faith seriously. Johann Tetzel, the indulgence salesman extraordinaire and Luther critic, is reputed to have said some version of the following: as soon as the gold in the casket rings, the rescued soul to heaven springs. Thus, a showdown within the boundaries of the Catholic Church was launched, though it is probably a surety that Luther had no intention of fracturing the Church and creating a new form of public Christianity. Yet that was the result, as Luther and John Calvin and so many others began the process of breaking apart the Church and creating what would eventually be known as Protestantism. Luther was not the first to start a challenge of church practices. Jan Hus had challenged church doctrine a century earlier, only to be branded a heretic and roasted at the stake. What Luther and others started became the Reformation, an attempt by a variety of theologians, lay leaders, church figures, and political and dynastic rulers to strip away the excesses, power, and land of the official church. Some, like Luther, took their faith so seriously it appeared to occupy their every thought. Others, like Henry Tudor, more regularly referred to as Henry VIII, had less theological reasons to circumvent the power and reach of the Catholic Church. What came over the next 500 years was a major cultural change which inspired not only the theology in all forms, but also the science and art and music and culture of Europe and beyond, as people reimagined the ways in which they might practice their faith, approach their God, and assess the meaning of their place in the universe. Flash forward a couple of centuries, and we see an America, and even an American South, that grew into its own cultural identity, in large part due to the ramifications of the Reformation. Many of the European imports into colonial America came to this land to live as practicing Puritans, Baptists, Huguenots, Methodists, Anglicans, and so many other forms of Christianity. And when they came, they mapped their culture and their beliefs into what became a new country, dedicated in part to the premise of freedom of religion. Our topic for today, the Reformation, and the torrent of cultural changes it unleashed across Europe and eventually the rest of the world. Joining me today are Ray Sutherland, Charles Beam, Richard Gay, and Joss Bussman. Welcome, everybody.
Hey, thank you.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In addition to the sale of indulgences, Charles, what are some of the other issues motivating these reformers?
Well, indulgences is just one aspect of a much larger protest. And when we look at this, what the name of this movement, the Protestant Reformation, it's a protest movement, but it is also a movement that seeks to reform the church also. So what Martin Luther didn't have in common with the vast majority of European Christians was that he was literate and he could read the Bible. And in the Bible are the scriptures, the words of Jesus in the New Testament. But much of what the Catholic Church practiced was extra spiritual, in that over the course of 1,000 years of the Middle Ages, the Church had built up a body of precedent and laws that claimed, among other things, the idea of papal supremacy. So popes claimed the authority that they could issue documents that could remit your sins from purgatory, but they also made other kinds of decisions that, in a sense, overrode scripture. For instance, Henry VIII challenges the powers of the papacy by saying that the popes did not have the authority to issue dispensations for brothers to marry their brothers' widows. So it was, in many ways, a much larger attack on papal authority. But at the same time, this is all wrapped up with large-scale corruption, in which the church, despite its wealth, despite its influence, despite its political and economic power, was widely seen as corrupt. We know this from such popular works of literature as Geoffrey Chaucer's The Canterbury Tales, in which members of the church are doing everything but being religious. So Luther, in a sense, is breaking the door open for a more literate interpretation of Christianity, one that sets aside the rules, the sacraments, the chastity required of priests, so that he can envision a more personal form of Christianity that would allow an individual Christian to bypass all those rules and regulations to make a personal relationship with God and seek solace in the words of the scriptures. So in addition to everything else that he did, Luther actually thought the most important thing that he did was to translate the Bible into German. And of course, it was against the law to translate the Bible into any vernacular language, because obviously if people read the Bible, they form their own interpretations. And the church had a lot riding on the fact that everyone needs to play by their rules.
So indulgences is a big issue. It's far from the only other issue. How does the rest of these other issues fit in?
One thing we have to remember is that religious movements don't take place in some religious vacuum. Mm-hmm. Just religion and nothing else. There was a lot going on in Europe at the time. The rise of nation states, kings gaining more power, German internal politics. That's always important in Europe. Just look at today. And importantly, major changes in the way people thought about the world. Humanism was coming up and becoming strong. The idea that things have to be put to empirical tests, which led to some big changes in the way they thought. But a major change there was technological. Luther had the printing press to use. He could disseminate his ideas. You know, he put the 95 theses out there, but he'd printed up a whole lot of copies. Church tried to find them all and destroy them, according to tradition, but they couldn't do it because he'd mailed them to everybody he knew. So church trying to destroy them apparently just drew attention to the copies that were left. And, of course, he could print up more anyway. So the printing press made a big difference. Luther could get his ideas out. They couldn't be stopped. And I think very important theologically, the Reformation simply could not happen without most people having some access to the Bible. Now, a lot of folks weren't literate, but there were some that were, and the printing press meant Bibles were available now, and every large church had a copy of the Bible. So anybody that wanted to could go to the big church and at least hear the Bible read. They didn't have to be able to read, they could hear it read. A lot of things were coming together.
And until this wave of literacy and printing press really takes root, a lot of people are sampling their theology through music and through art. How does that fit into ordinary folk getting some sense of the issues that they might want reformed?
Well, when we think about the use of images, it was a great fear of idolatry that was taking place here. The Bible clearly states that you shouldn't make any graven images. This is coming out of the book of Exodus. It's one of the Ten Commandments. And so the church, through tradition, as Charles had mentioned, had set up this really interesting thing. The Bible is telling you not to make images, and then you have Pope Gregory the Great saying that images are the books of the illiterate, that they can be used to teach things. And throughout the entire Middle Ages, well, even today, people are still debating this idea, can images truly serve as a book for the illiterate? And there's been studies that argue that, well, they just cannot, because it can only remind us of information that we already know. You can create juxtapositions of images that can suggest certain things, but it's very difficult to tell a very clear, concise story. For example, you don't know who the figures are unless you already know, unless they're labeled. So there's a tendency to rely on a text. So there's this fear of idolatry that comes into play with this. And one of the key things that takes place during the Protestant Reformation is acts of iconoclasm. And we know the Wittenberg Church suffered from iconoclasm when Luther had gone out of town when he was being pressured by the papacy and some others. So he had left town. There was a stand-in preacher that day. His name was Andreas Karlstadt, and he got the congregation fired up. And he said, these images can be idolatrous. The Old Testament tells us we're not supposed to do this. They take us away from the inner faith that we should be concentrating on, and they lead us to worldly ideas. And so the congregation ends up smashing the objects that are found in the church. That takes place quite often in the areas of Protestantism. The stained glass windows get broken, the idols get broken, for example.
Imagine if Luther had taken a selfie and put it on Instagram.
That would be interesting. But the interesting thing is Luther himself wasn't against the use of images. He returned, and he clearly said that there's nothing wrong with images. They're just not that important. He was concerned that the images could lead to false truths. For example, if you have lots of images of saints being venerated, for example, that could lead to the belief that that an individual needs some type of intercessor on their behalf, be it the Virgin Mary or a saint. And of course, with Protestantism, the word and individual faith is what is needed. So you don't need an intercessor. So if you have a church full of images of saints, you may be sending the wrong message. So if you had the right type of image, Luther was okay with that.
Josh, how does the music fit in?
In terms of the music, one thing, and this goes along with a lot of things that other people have been saying, is if at the end of the Middle Ages and the beginning of the Renaissance, there's all of this sort of corruption in the Catholic Church, meaning that there's a lot of money in the Catholic Church, it means a lot of musicians are being employed by the Catholic Church, and they're doing a lot of really wild things. The music that comes out, in particular, of the south of France towards the end of the Middle Ages is some of the most experimental music that we see really until the 20th century, the Ars Nova and the Ars Subtilior. And they're wrapped up with this question of the church's confidence, because so many of them are employed by this papal court that is established at Avignon when the papacy moves out of Rome in the Middle Ages, and then we have this schism. And obviously, if there's a schism in the church, you have two popes at the same time, they're excommunicating one another. It's not a great PR move, and not a great way to instill confidence in the people who are sitting in the pews, especially when the wrong line of papal succession might lead to you getting a sacrament that isn't actually consecrated properly. There's very high stakes for this going wrong. So in addition to some of the other excesses that have been described, there is this sort of musical excess in terms of complexity and experimentation that is being pursued by certain composers at the end of the Renaissance, or the end of the Middle Ages, beginning of the Renaissance, because of this tremendous amount of wealth that has flowed into the church.
Well, let's set the power of the church in context, because these reformers who are challenging it for one way or another are really taking on the most important cultural institution, the most important political institution in so many ways, in Europe at the time. Describe the power of the church at this point in time before the Reformation.
I would call it a federal structure, mm-hmm. in which in all the states of Europe, sovereign nations with their own governments, at the same time, you know, kings complained that they were only kings of half their subjects, mm-hmm. because the church had its own hierarchy in every country, and it had its own court system, its own legal system. It collected taxes. But members of the church also served their royal masters as ministers also. So you have the point where at the time that Luther is nailing his theses on the church door, you have Cardinal Wolsey in England, who is both the religious leader in England as a cardinal and a papal legate. At the same time, he is Chancellor of England. So in many ways, his position becomes untenable when there is going to be this conflict between being a servant of the church and being a servant of the king. So for England, for instance, or the other German states to break away and form their national churches, in a sense, they are seceding from this federal structure. And there's no army to bring them back into the fold. So Henry VIII gets away with his reformation. So does Frederick of Saxony. And they simply, there is no recourse in many ways. The spread of the Reformation exposes the powerlessness of the church.
Well, there were attempts by the church to remove it. The Schmalkald War, I'm not sure what the name is, and the 30 Years' War had at least a component. There aren't any really religious wars, but religion plays a role in several wars, and those two it definitely did. So,
well, but those are nations fighting wars.
Exactly. Those are the German states fighting each other, but it's the ones that are allied with Italy versus the ones that were not allied with Italy. So
Right. While
religion played a role, it wasn't really a religious war. It was always over mines and wheat fields and river traffic and things of that nature.
Religious wars are never about just religion.
No.
So we have this massive institutional church that's a gigantic landowner, has the power in the minds of its adherents to decide the eternal destiny of their soul. And then we have these challenges starting off and beginning to spread. Discuss a little bit the varied motivations of the reformers. Some are just reading their scripture and wanting the church to be as relevant and real as possible, and others see an opportunity to get ahead in the midst of this. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, when I teach the Reformation, I teach that it starts with a spiritual protest and a quest for a spiritual reform movement, but inevitably there are going to be both economic and political consequences. Many of the princes of Germany, as well as the kings of England, the kings of Sweden, and Denmark, realized that if they broke away from the Roman Catholic Church and created a national church controlled by the state, that they would be in a position to confiscate lots of land, confiscate sources of income, and considerably bolster the power of the state. We see this most clearly in England, where after Henry VIII becomes supreme head of the church, he confiscates all the monastic land in England, strips it of its wealth, and basically kicks all the monks out and closes all the schools and really appropriates all these resources for the state.
And not that the popes were necessarily paragons of virtue over history, but Henry certainly, as the concept of church leader, is a bit rich.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, his is a jurisdictional reformation. Mm-hmm. The spiritual one comes down the road with Edward VI,
and then Cranmer had some spiritual goals too.
Oh yes, but Cranmer had to be a closet Protestant until Henry dies, as most everyone else did.
With the church being so involved in subvention of art and music, how are artists in music seeing these things ripple out? Are they lingering fast to their patrons, or are they trying to unleash the creativity that they might want to get into?
Well, you mentioned Cranmer and the sort of situation in England under Henry VIII, and two of the composers that are working in this sort of space in England are still two of the most famous English composers of all time, Thomas Tallis and William Byrd. In fact, when I go to my Episcopal church on a Sunday and I open it up, a lot of the tunes in the hymnal are still Thomas Tallis tunes from that period of the 16th century. And again, as I sort of said before, musicians tend to be very canny about pleasing the people who write their paychecks. And so Talis and Bird are doing this extended dance over the course of 40 or 50 years where, yes, Henry comes in and sort of establishes this new Protestant orthodoxy, but over the course of a series of changes between Henry and Elizabeth, we have some waffling on what the state's official position is going to be, and they are very adept at doing the dance that is asked of them, writing everything from traditional Latin mass settings and Latin motets and part songs to these new sort of English anthem-style pieces and hymn tunes that are appropriate for congregational singing. So they're really they're happy to negotiate this treacherous terrain.
It's like a band who doesn't mind playing their greatest hits as long as they get paid.
Exactly so, yeah.
Right. Well, you had mentioned in your question this idea of creativity among artists, and that's really more of a modern concept of what an artist is. When we think about artists in this period, yes, in the Renaissance we have a tremendous artist, but we also have to remember that they were largely socially considered craftsmen and laborers, and they had to respond to market demands and what the patron wanted. Is we have contracts from 1466 that clearly tell the artist what they're going to paint, what they're going to paint it with. You're not going to use the cheap color blue. You're going to use the expensive blue. You're going to get it done by this such and such a time, or I'm not going to pay you. So they were clearly responding to market demands. And I was thinking about your idea of indulgences earlier because it's such a key issue. I mean, we know that the indulgences were sold to redo St. Peter's, for example. A lot of the money went there. The money coming from this sale of indulgences filtered into the great works of Michelangelo and other great artists as well. So the wealth is really a significant thing. So artists, of course, wanted to be able to make a living. So they were concerned with that. Some artists in Protestant areas clearly lost their ability to make a living. They were without jobs, right? So they would have to look for other options. Some artists would start to become more of portrait painters instead of images of the faith. Some became more interested in landscapes, for example. So there are lots of options for artists to take. But back to this idea of indulgences, some of the artists before the Reformation were actually making works of art that were part of the indulgence economy. There's a famous image by Simon Marmion, who is a French early Netherlandish painter, and he created an image of the Mass of St. Gregory. And at the bottom of this image, there's an inscription, and the inscription clearly explains that, thanks to good old Pope St. Gregory, that if you're on your knees before this image and you say the right prayers, they were actually called the verses of St. Gregory, you said these prayers, and you also said a Paternosters along with those, and you would receive an indulgence for having used this object to help focus your intention. So art was playing into the religious needs of the time, and the artists were responding to those needs.
Just to quickly tie together a couple of things that have been said and something that happens musically again in England is Talis and Bird, these two composers that I was talking about towards the end of their careers, they're actually given a sort of state-sanctioned monopoly over the printing of music in England by Queen Elizabeth, essentially because there's a certain type of paper you need to print music at the time, and the Queen happens to control all of it, and she says that only they are allowed to use it. And so I think that drives home both your point, Richard, about the sort of market forces that are so important for artists and musicians to make a living, and your point, Charles, about the sort of jurisdictional Reformation as much as the spiritual Reformation.
I just want to add one more element about art. Some artists were employed in creating, you know, anti-Catholic art.
Oh, well, most
definitely.
There's
some great images, for instance, showing Pope Leo X sitting at his desk with his big papal crown, and he's got a big stack of indulgences behind him. And he's sitting there operating like a merchant, you know, selling these. And obviously, there doesn't even need to be a caption. You know, we can see what's happening in action.
Luther, interesting enough, had dreamt of a picture Bible for the layman. Mm-hmm. And he goes so far as to say if he would like to find a rich man who would take the images from that Bible and paint it on the inside and outside of their house for the instruction of the people. So this idea of images being used in a very positive way, both pro and against the Reformation, it's really, really strong and very compelling in the period.
The economic part of the art, you can see that in Albrecht Dürer. He had to play both sides against the middle.
Oh, didn't he, though?
And he was partly Catholic, partly Protestant. Most folks think he was at his heart a Protestant, but he didn't mind taking Catholic money either. So he had to paint images that would work for both sides, and quite successfully.
And I was thinking about Albrecht Dürer and what artists what voices artists have from the period, because we don't have a lot of text from artists. And I was thinking about, well, what text do we have where artists are speaking about their objects? And I have a quote from Albrecht Dürer that he wrote from 1525. He says that, and they will not be misled by those among us, even in our own day, who will revile the art of painting and to say that it is a servant of idolatry. For a Christian would no more be led to superstition by a picture or an effigy than an honest man to commit murder because he carries a weapon at his side. He must indeed be an unthinking man who would worship a picture, wood, or stone. A picture, therefore, brings more good than harm when it is honorably, artistically, and well made. So he presents his case there for producing images.
Yes, he did write treatises about art, and they...
Oh, yeah.
I haven't read them, so I can't tell you what they said, but he was aware that there was a theoretical function as well as commercial.
Richard mentioned a few minutes ago laymen. Let's turn our attention to the ordinary European. The Protestant Reformation is picking up speed. New churches are being formed. New denominations, sects even, are being formed. How is the ordinary person in a Protestant environment worshiping differently? What are they singing? What's happening in their church that's a little different than under the Catholic Church? And what are the denominations that are starting to grow out of these ashes?
Well, some of these anxieties that Richard was just talking about in terms of the power of images, right? I mean, if one of the things that the Reformation is pushing back against is these sort of excesses and potential sort of emotional manipulations of the Catholic Church, music certainly can be pegged with being able to do both of those things. And so I think there's a lot of suspicion around music as well as images and other things coming into this new period. And actually, you mentioned Andreas Karlstadt before, who is not only a church leader, but also kind of Luther's dissertation advisor when he's working on his first sort of big theological projects. And Karlstadt really encapsulates this in a work he has from the beginning of the period, where he says one of the conundrums that musicians face in Protestant worship is that presumably because the object of worship is God himself, then we would want the music to be of the highest possible quality, right? There's no other situation where you would want to play more beautifully and more profoundly than in the context of worshiping God. And yet, the amount of sort of focus and skill that would be required to play that way would necessarily prohibit you from fully inhabiting the space of worship. And so you have to sort of make this compromise where you can't quite play complex music perfectly because it takes you out of the worship space. And I think that conundrum leads to, over the course of time, this simplification and focus on congregational singing, in part because it gets around some of that conundrum.
Praise songs.
Yeah, exactly so. Right.
The other side of that is the politics of it, and the Reformation was as much a political movement as it was. Mentioned the printing press and Luther disseminating his works a while ago. Printing was still expensive, even with the printing press. Luther did not have that kind of money. So you find out what's going on, you follow the money. And it was Duke Friedrich's money. And he was after a political goal, which was that Italian alliance we talked about a while ago. He was trying to break it. So he was willing to spend the money to help Luther out. So there was a political element to the Reformation, and the political leaders were very much involved in it, not just from a confessional standpoint, although Duke Friedrich was apparently devout, but there was also the political ends, which all the German states lined up against each other, with Prussia playing both ends against the middle, of course. So there was a political element as well as economic and religious.
Well, didn't the ruler get, after around 1555 or so with Augsburgs, didn't the ruler get to select the
yes,
religion of the
that
territory?
Yes, the Peace of Augsburg.
So that ties right in there.
One of its stipulations that made the Reformation a done deal. It wasn't going back after that.
We'll return to 30 Brave Minutes in a moment. But first, thank you for listening and for your financial support of the College of Arts and Sciences. Please consider a contribution to the Arts and Sciences Dean's Fund. The fund exists to help students and faculty make meaningful connections to the community, the state, and beyond through intellectual inquiry, scholarships, and research in the humanities, social sciences, and STEM fields. Consider a contribution today. Mark your envelope, the Dean's Fund, College of Arts and Sciences, UNCP, Hickory Hall, Pembroke, North Carolina, 28372. Or call the College of Arts and Sciences at 910-521-6198. You can also find us on the web. And now, back to 30 Brave Minutes and your host, Jeff Frederick.
What kind of changes do we see in an ordinary European and eventually outside of Europe in the age of exploration as they begin to sample religion in their own language, as they begin to interact with it in a non-Latin, non-official, non-ritualized manner? How does that change the way they're spending their time and some of their money?
Well, I mean, I think you certainly see this rise in different forms of personal devotion, and I think that at least in music, that is brought about in part in a total change, a sort of rethinking of the way that music is supposed to operate in worship, that actually has to do with this broader trend of humanism that a number of us have mentioned in the conversation. So this, not to get too technical, right, but if you were trained in a medieval educational institution, music would have been part of the quadrivium. It would have been part mm-hmm. of this sort of set of four natural sciences, basically. And so the reason why you studied music is the reason why the ancient Greeks studied music, because it was sounded mathematics and it helped to explain sort of how the world was put together. When you got into the Reformation, in this rise of humanism, music actually was sort of shifted in the way that it was taught and was shifted into the trivium as a sort of subset of rhetoric. And so suddenly music is not about exploring these harmonious building blocks of the cosmos. It's actually about communicating a message. Many of the writers in the sphere of Calvin in particular are very concerned with music and its message. Right, Luther talks about music and these very sort of complex, sort of counterpointed voices tripping over one another as being this religious experience in and of itself. But in other corners of the Reformation, like the Calvinist corners in France and Switzerland, there is a great deal of suspicion of that, because if music is going to embed this message so deeply within us, we have to be very, very careful about what messages we're playing with. So one of the things that congregations would have seen very, very quickly is the depleting of sort of musical instruments and complex musical compositions, the move towards the singing of strictly biblical texts, usually psalms and canticles, singing them in unison together without any sort of harmony. And in fact, they said that they didn't want instruments to be involved, not just because of the sound, because they wanted them to hear one another, but because if there was an instrument at the front of the church and you happened to look at it while you were singing, you might accidentally commit idolatry. So if you weren't looking at anything except this disembodied experience of singing, then perhaps that risk was less. So one of the things that would lead to, though, is not only are you reading these vernacular versions of Scripture, but you're singing these vernacular versions of Scripture, too. And we all know that when you sing something, it can get sort of lodged in your brain even more profoundly than when you read it sometimes.
And that non-instrumental nature of it carries on. Some denominations, or they would probably not prefer that term denomination, but Disciples of Christ, Church of Christ, plenty of them still sing non-instrumental mm-hmm. music without harmonies.
But none of these changes happen overnight. In fact, they evolve. Most English historians of the Reformation would say, and I agree with them, that the Reformation basically took 50 years to sort of sink in mm-hmm. and change the culture, change the way people believed. When Edward VI becomes king in 1547, basically Protestantism is confined to London, which is, of course, this huge city, and the rest of the country is not urban. So in many ways, London exercises this, you know, outsized influence on the way that Protestantism develops. But basically, it takes decades to convert the people of England to the doctrine of the Church of England. And so this is a rough process. We see divides in our country today between urban and rural. We could say the exact same thing about the mm-hmm. 16th century, in which people in the West Country, in the North, are actually very wedded to Catholic belief. They love the music. They love the pomp and the ritual of it. These had great meanings for people, and these, of course, Protestants, you don't need any of that. You know, all you need to do is believe. So by the end of the reign of Elizabeth can we say that the vast majority of the people of England have become converted to this belief, where you have Puritans on your fringe over here who want a further purification of the church, and then people who remain Catholics on the other end. So the change in culture is slow and steady, and music evolves, church liturgies evolve, readings from the Bible become very central to sermons, you know, whereas the Mass was just in Latin and no one knows what anyone's saying. So, these are sort of incremental processes.
You talked about the rural people. History was written by people who were literate and could afford paper and pen and ink. So we have less knowledge about what the farmers out in the countryside were thinking. And for the most part, I'm firmly convinced that they were minimally aware of all this stuff we're talking about. And even though there are significant theological and political movements, these people were a lot more concerned about a sick cow than they were about the things we're discussing. And they were hugely more concerned with the sick child than this. So their main interest in religion was getting Jesus into their village that day to help them fight the devils. And however that way will work best, they're okay with that. So as you pointed out, it took a while for anybody to really notice that there was a real change. And they still went to the roadside shrine and still prayed and still tried to run the devils out, because the devils were there, making their cows sick, making their kids sick, making things disappear. So sometimes we overemphasize the importance of this to the standard population. They knew it was going on, but they weren't really terribly concerned, except maybe kind of as a spectator sport.
Yeah, I think sort of to bring together things that both of you just said, the first being this sort of divide between urban and rural in these different corners. I think one of the reasons why I often come back to Luther and Calvin as these sort of emblematic figures is there's a generational divide, there's this sort of culture divide. You know, Luther was trained as an Augustinian monk, and he always carries that background with him, whereas Calvin never really participates in an order of the church. He comes up as a lawyer, he's fully embedded in this humanist context, and he's a lot younger, and so he brings this very different perspective, in addition to the fact that a lot of my research was on and around Calvin, so I tend to know that stuff better. But around that research, right, one of the questions that drew me to that Calvinist sort of thing in France and Switzerland was that so many of the writings seem to have this hard line, say, against music, for instance, right? We don't want this music in multiple parts. We don't want this music that has a great deal of decoration or ventures outside of scriptural texts. And yet in every town and village in France, you find music that does exactly those things by people who consider themselves to be very devout practitioners of the faith. And so it is never as simple as simply looking at the top and pushing it downward.
And the people were singing in harmony while they would cut hay and harvest wheat.
Exactly so.
Singing something. What a great discussion. I want to thank our panel for really attacking a 500-year-old concept that really still is in place today as issues of reform and how to worship and who should worship in what way continue to be a part of discussions here and elsewhere. I hope you've enjoyed listening to 30 Brave Minutes, and if you have, pass it on to a friend. We'll see you next time.
Today's podcast was produced by Richard Gay and transcribed by Janet Gentis. Theme music created by Riley Morton. This content is copyrighted by the University of North Carolina at Pembroke, UNCP, and the College of Arts and Sciences. It is to be used for educational and non-commercial purposes only, and is not to be changed, altered, or used for any commercial endeavor without the express written permission of authorized representatives of UNCP. The views and opinions expressed by any individuals during the course of these discussions are their own and do not necessarily represent the views, opinions, and positions of UNCP or any of its subsidiary programs, schools, departments, and divisions. While reasonable efforts have been made to ensure that information discussed is current and accurate at the time of release, neither UNCP nor any individual presenting material makes any warranty that information presented in the original recording has remained accurate due to advances in research, technology, or industry standards.
Thanks for listening to 30 Brave Minutes, and go Braves.